Darkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2015. Lecture 1, delivered on August 17, 2015. The title of this lecture is Introduction to Finance.
Today, Introduction to Finance. As I told you, this course is Surveys and Introduction, and this lecture is really Introduction. Having taught for quite a few years Business 100, I know that some of these subjects were actually covered in that class, but on a very light level for freshman students. Now you're farther along, and I take you more in depth into some things that you were already exposed to in another class before this. You might have also been shown this in another course like accounting. They might have brought this up. Fortunately, you're getting it from me now, so you'll get it right. Let me kill this off here. The first thing that I will do, woman, have you ever made money doing something like babysitting or mowing lawns? You have. Have you? And you, of course, reported it as tax on your taxes. You're the accountant. Of course you would. But you reported all the money you made on the side, doing extra things for people. I'm not talking about working at Mickey D's or something like that. I'm talking about actually just mowing lawns or something like that. You've all done that. In fact, you are engaging in the by far largest kind of business in the world. What is called the sole proprietorship. It's just a one-person show. Just a one-person show. There is no one else but you. No one else is in that business but you. You mow lawns. You walk a dog. You drag a cat. You provide personal services to elderly women. Cougar bait are us. Indeed. I know, right? Yeah, it's a dirty job, but someone has to do it. This is the life cycle of most businesses, is that they really start as small things that just go nowhere, or they just kind of flop along for years and years. I have run sole proprietorships for ages, and once in a while, one of them would have enough strength that I might up it to something more formal. But for the most part, a sole proprietorship just kind of sits there on its own. When you die, the sole proprietorship dies. It is not something separate from you. It is just you, and you could use your own name. Or you could use a DBA, a doing business as. Now, every state gives you the ability to file a form and go through a process to get state recognition of your fictitious name. In Illinois, it's called a fictitious name, I think. In some states, it's called an assumed name. But it's a DBA, a doing business as. So you could be, what's your name, son?
Dan.
Dan's dog walking service. But then you get tired of walking dogs and you decide that you want to upscale yourself and you change your name to Rudolph, and it's Rudolph's massage service. Okay? Then you have a DBA. You can file with the state and say, it's a process, and I show in Business 100 how the process works. I've done it a number of times in several states I've lived in, where I just wanted to protect something that was my name, but carried some more respectable thing than Alan Kring. The one that has survived the longest, which I created out here in this state, was Dark Wraith Publishing. And you'll hear the podcasts are all under the label of Dark Wraith Publishing, as is most of my media content. It's a sole proprietorship. I worked through the process. The way it works in Illinois is you go to the county, you ask them for a form, or you can download it now. You fill it out, you take it back to the clerk of courts, the county recorder, and they stamp it, and they give it back to you, and they say, now you have to have this published in some kind of a business journal in the state for, I think it's 3 weeks. And if no one challenges your claim to this fictitious name, the publisher will send you a notice that there was no challenge. You bring that notice back with your form that we've stamped initially, and you've got the name. That's how it works in Illinois, and it's similar to that in most states. And there are all these cheapo business publications. It's, all they do is this kind of stuff. It's just Alan Kring has filed for the fictitious name Dark Wraith Publishing. And it just goes for 3 weeks, and no one challenged it, so I got the message back that I had gotten this name, and then I went back down to the clerk's office, and they stamped it. It's yours. And then a couple of days later, they sent me this nice big placard, hard card thing that you can frame that says, this is yours. This the name of this this business is yours. That's a sole proprietorship. Now, in some cases, you could upscale and go to something a little bit stronger, like a partnership or a corporation. If you go to a corporation, you would have to assign the name to the corporation. But at the start, it's a fictitious name. Now, here's the problem, though. You run a lawn service. You mow lawns. You're a sole proprietor. You run under the DBA, I Mow Lawns. Okay? People can write a check to I Mow Lawns. And you can even work out, a lot of banks and credit unions will let you actually show them your paperwork from the state, and they'll say, oh, okay, if you get a check, then you can bring in checks with this DBA, and you sign them on the back, and we'll know they go to your account and all that. But I mow lawns, okay? Well, you mow lawns for wealthy people, and one day you're mowing a lawn, and you don't recognize that the lady's very expensive poodle is in front of you, and you give that dog a show dog trim. She'll sue your ass. Back to the Stone Age. Okay? Now, she will take you for everything you have. She will take your lawnmower, that ugly-ass truck of yours, and she'll then go to your apartment, then she'll sue, and they'll take away those lame Nickelback CDs of yours. And everything else in there, including that big bag of Cheetos. You are all at risk. You get all the money, but you also have to face the fact that if your company is sued, the company is you in a sole proprietorship. So they can just anyone who sues you can walk right through and take everything you have, okay? Remember this about liabilities. They come before ownership. In any court in the land, a liability holder against you or any company, even a corporation, comes before the equity, the ownership. So if you default on, let's say you default on a bond, you're a corporation, you can't pay the payments on a bond, the bondholders can go right into your corporation, they will shoot your dog, sell your Bible on Craigslist, and make your mother wear furry costumes that please them. They can do that. Mrs. Fox, it's a real good starter outfit. Oh, okay. Understand that about everything we do is that once we are indebted, either through volition or through running over a dog, whatever it is, you are in an exposure position, and the exposure takes precedence over the equity, over the ownership. Now, that's true of all of these that I'm going to do for you. There's a sole proprietorship right there. You are all at risk. It is a one-person show. One person. Doing it all. You You're responsible for the bills. You get to keep the money. That's how it works. But like I said, that's the largest kind in the world. And honestly, most of the money that I've made in my other ventures has been in sole proprietorships. Now, in several cases, I was up at the level of a corporation in some of the big ones that I did over the years. But for the most part, it was just sole proprietorship stuff. When I was did a lot for years, my consulting was just basically sole proprietorship. And the taxes are kind of a pain in the butt for a sole proprietorship, just like they are for everything else. But there you go. Okay, now, partnership is the next level. It is essentially very much like a sole proprietorship, except that it's more than one person, and they are jointly and severally liable, all at risk. There's a problem with that, you see, because, looking around here, one thing that kind of, I look at people in these rooms and I think, who would be a good person to work a business with? And I'm looking at you, sir. You and I could start a partnership. Now, here's a thing about a partnership. Once you and I are formally, legally partners, anything you do, I have done. You make money, we have made money. Don't be pissed off if I take half of what you have. But if you screw up, I have screwed up too. There is no distinction between us in the terms of the partnership. That's why when you go, a lot of companies, there are certain industries like accounting, architecture, investment brokerage houses that do their business as partnerships. And that's why they make it so hard for you to become a partner. They haze you to death. They make your life miserable because they need to know before they turn you from an associate into a partner that they can all trust you, because if you screw up, they have all screwed up. Did any of you see the movie Pursuit of Happiness, Will Smith movie? It's a few years old now, but you saw that ungodly process Smith and those other guys went through to get for one of them to be taken in as a partner. That was, by the way, a true story, that movie was. And it's just like that in accounting firms. They just make your life just totally miserable, push you to your limits and beyond, because they've got to make sure that you can be trusted if you are one of them. Now, here's an interesting thing about partnerships, is that like sole proprietorships, they die when one of the people in the thing dies. Didn't mean to do that. In other words, a sole proprietorship, just like a partnership, is mortal. You and I are partners, okay? If you die, that's the end of the partnership. It closes. It's over. Because it is nothing but us. And if part of us is gone, you can't assign it to your spouse. You can't assign it to your kid. It doesn't work that way. It's over. That's why these partnerships like law firms, they construct them in such a way that they're essentially when one of the partners dies, the thing just folds over and comes back to life with the assets of the old partnership and essentially a new partnership by the same name. No one on the outside sees that, but that's what's happening on the inside. By the way, a partnership, you can run a sole proprietorship any day you want. Yeah, and as long as you take care of your taxes, you're going to be left alone. But if you form a partnership, you actually have to file forms with the state that you are in a partnership. You have to have a real contract. It's much more formal. You have to have a partnership agreement that is on file with the state of Illinois, and if you're in Illinois, and all that good stuff. So know that it is more formal, but other than that, it is very similar to sole proprietorship, except that there are two flavors of partnerships. There is a general partnership, And then there is a limited partnership. Now, I can tell you about limited partnerships because I used to do them long ago. A general partnership is just like I described to you. It's just a partnership. You know, two men in a bus or something, two blokes in a truck or whatever. But there's a trick you can play where you create a partnership and there are general partners. And then you can go out and sell limited partnership units for others to invest. The limited partners are limited in their liability. They cannot lose beyond their investment. The general partners, it's just like, so they're all at risk. But the limited partners are limited in their liability to their investment, but they cannot touch the partnership's management at all. They have to sit back and just watch the action from a distance. There are some limited partnerships that are total scams. They've been, but there are other limited partnerships that are huge successes. And they've actually, this structure has benefited a lot of people over the years. I'll give you an example of one. I was engaged in a series of these. They were called Low Income Housing for the Elderly Partnerships. Back in the 80s, and really even to this day to a certain extent, but there was a program by the federal and many states that would give to companies that were going to build low-income housing for the elderly. They would give them low-interest and no-interest loans and grants to build apartments, nice apartments for old people, and then the old people would get the rent subsidized through another program by the government. So the trick that we did, it wasn't really a trick, we would set up a general partnership. It was there only for the purpose of doing an apartment complex. Nothing huge, I'm talking, you know, like 30, 50, 100 units. Nice apartments, clean, nice carpet and all that. And maybe some kind of a common place in the middle where the old people could go to enjoy themselves in the evenings and all that. But what we would do is we would set ourselves up as the general partners in this. We would get the money together. Now, here's the thing about it, though. We would then go out and raise money by selling limited partnership units to rich people, doctors, lawyers, accountants, dentists, architects, and all kinds of other people. We'd sell limited partnership units to these people. Now, here was the trick. The government said, we will give you grant money and low-interest loans if you have the matching funds on your own. That's why we were raising the money through the limited partnerships. It was essentially, we had to, in the old days, we called it commit blood. Now they call it commit skin. But if we would commit blood, $5 million, they would match that blood with government grants and low and no-interest loans. So we would just set it up. We get the money together anywhere from, some of them were as $2 million. The biggest was like a $12 million one. And then the government would match up and we would build the apartment complex and then we would essentially run it under a management company. Now, the thing was that then our investors would get their, they were not allowed to do anything but except wait for their money. And, of course, every year we would send them two tax forms. One was a K-1, how much money you have made off this project. And then another one represented the value of the asset increase. Well, of course, the value of the asset decreased terribly year to year. We would depreciate the hell out of the thing, so it was spiraling downward. So they get a loss. A rather nasty loss there. And then, of course, the partnership itself was losing money out the butt. We were paying ourselves very well. And we were also spending like drunken sailors. And so these rich people would get two bloody loss documents that they would have to just be happy with. And they were just thrilled. I mean, it wouldn't take long before they'd be calling us back. They wanted to know when the next limited partnership was coming. Please let us invest. Please. What the hell? Why would they be doing that? I mean, we were talking in the first years, bloody losses per investor were maybe $40,000. And the depreciation, the loss on asset value could be as much as per investor, maybe on the order of $30,000, $40,000, $50,000. They were losing money out the wazoo. They had put $50,000 or $100,000 into our projects, and they were getting losses every year. Why were they so happy with us? Taxes. They put $100,000 into a project, and every year, against the income that they were actually earning in their profession, they were saying, I lost this, I lost this, I lost this. Within a couple of years, 3 to 5 years, they had more than doubled their recovery just from taxes they didn't pay to the federal and state government because they were all paper losses. They were paper. All they put in is $100,000, and they were shielding their hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars of rich people income from taxes by saying, well, we lost this much, so you can't tax us on this money we earned as doctors, dentists, architects, and lawyers. You see the trick? They were tax loss vehicles. The government knew what we were doing. That was the whole point of it. We were inducing rich people to help poor old people live in nice places and have a decent and dignified elderly experience. It worked. It was a beautiful thing. We did it over and over again. Over and over again. Another one that I was involved in was a Texas twist for oil and gas operation. By the way, in Texas, there are no two-syllable words. Say Texas. No, in down there it's Texas, one word, one syllable. Say Houston.
Houston.
Say Dallas.
Dallas.
Dallas. Say oil and gas.
Oil and gas.
Oil and gas. When I first started working with oil men down in Texas, they sat me down and they taught me, you don't talk like you do up there in the north, boy. Yes, evil masters. But anyway, the twist that we had, we were wildcatters. And this was back in the 80s and the 90s. We had a guy, he was a petrogeologist, old-time country Texas boy. And he was brilliant at finding oil patches. I'm not talking about giant oil fields, just enough to punch a couple of holes and make some money. Strangest thing about this guy was, his name was Bill, and he was a creationist. He believed that the earth was made 6,000 years ago, but that boy could find dinosaur oil down there. He could just look. Well, that graben out there, I think there's a couple of wells good in that. So what we would do is we'd need the money to get to rent a rig, to get some roughnecks, and to get all the other equipment all together. What we did is we created a general partnership. And then we would create limited partnerships. And then we'd go up north to rich people up north, and we'd sucker them into our partnerships by making them feel like Texas men. Yeah, you understand what we're doing down here. I'm sure we'll have you down there one of these days, get you some Red Wing boots so you can get out there with us and, you know, listen to this manly man equipment roaring around out there in the oil patch. We would play them, and they would put money in. But those limited partnerships had a nasty trick. They were called working interest partnerships. So that when we needed more money, they had to pony it up, and if they didn't put in more money as we needed it, their interest would fall. Their percent of ownership in the oil project would fall. So we knew very well that we could just start beating them up for money, and if they didn't put that money out there to buy us more stakes and more stuff like and trucks, we would just cut their interest down in it until finally they were pretty much all had 2-1%, and then we would push the roughnecks to hang that drill bit down far enough to get the oil out. Okay? Once we had winnowed their interest, the northern boys' interest down, we would then hit the oil. Well, we're digging. You can see it. We're pushing. We've gone down, what, 40 feet? Yeah, 40 feet. And once they were down, push it the rest of the way, get to the oil, and then we get the oil. I mean, we're not talking about fortunes here. We're talking about just squeezing 50, 100 barrels out of the ground a week or a month or whatever. But anyway, there's another one. One more about limited partnerships. They have become very popular. One of the places where limited partnerships first became very profitable was in porn in the 70s. All you needed to do was get together some limited partners, and then with the money you'd get your talent, you'd get your a couple of camera A, camera B, a couple of hotels, maybe a couple of days in the islands or something like that, and you could get yourself a movie made, print up about 50,000 VHS and beta copies of the movie, and distribute them through the adult network in the United States and Europe and in the Far East, and you would make a fortune. These were a big thing, and that was one of the reasons that industry became as large as it is today. Entertainment has finally figured out that trick from one of the evil parts of the entertainment industry, and limited partnerships are proliferating. One place you see them is in the indie film market. Some indie films are actually very professional operations. They do it as limited partnerships. You produce the movie on limited partnership money, and then you get a couple of showings at the Cannes Film Festival and the Toronto Festival and all that kind of stuff. Get a couple of accolades and acclaims. You sell it on through Amazon Instant Video. You get it on Netflix. You get some money off it. Everyone's happy. You can go on to the next movie. This is a very common thing. And a lot of these movies that look like amateur indie affairs are actually very pro operations. One of the best I like to mention as far as what looks like an indie movie that was very, very much a professional job was, does anyone know the first one of the first horror movies of the modern era? Now, you can go back to Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but in the modern era, the first movie that looked like it was done by amateurs with shaky cameras, what was it? Blair Witch, absolutely. Real pro operation, brilliant stuff. Now it's gone out into mainstream filmmaking. Some of the famous actors and actresses that got sick of the Hollywood moguls tearing apart their scripts and bossing everyone around, they're doing limited partnerships. You put a limited partnership together, get your budget, put together a good movie, get it on the A-list of screens around the United States, and then sell it in DVD and Blu-ray format, you got yourself a winner. It's also now spreading out into music. Some of the best artists now have just simply walked away from the big leagues, and they're now financing through limited partnerships the production of their albums. It's actually becoming very well done. Interestingly enough, one of the genres that was the first to figure out the limited partnership path to producing a music album and the associated video and all of that was hip hop. They figured that out right away, that you could get money from other people in limited partnerships, produce the album, get a revenue stream, limited partners make money, the general partners make scads of money, and there you go. You get a couple of product placements, like for example in music videos, every time a reference to McDonald's is made, McDonald's pays the artist $5. So you get it on some radio stations, you get it on CDs, and you got yourself a winner, and that flows to the limited partners and general partners. That's how the artistic scene is beginning to develop in a really good way right now. Next thing. This one I'm going to mention, and then I'm going to walk away from it. Too many textbooks, finance textbooks, written by people who have never had their heads outside of an ivy tower, bray about LLCs, limited liability companies. They are sort of like partnerships, except that all of the owners have limited liability. The debts and other liabilities can't go through to the owners. Now, a partnership, you're called a partner. In a limited liability company, you're called a member. And there has to be a membership agreement filed with the state of the partner of the company. It's unique from a partnership because you can essentially arrange the members in such a way that some members get more of the revenue flow But other members get more of the back end. Now, in a partnership and in a corporation, basically everyone is equal in distribution. But in a limited liability company, you've got that ability to... some of your members could be the ones who get the year-to-year money that the thing makes. But in an LLC, you could have some get the revenue from year to year. But others, when you collapse the LLC and you are supposed to have a, you're supposed to actually file a date when an LLC collapses. It's not supposed to be forever. And I have people just stare at me blankly. Oh, I made an LLC. Well, when does it end? Well, it ain't never going to end. Yeah, that's kind of like one of the points of it. That's one of the ways it's like a partnership. Except a partnership ends when someone dies. An LLC ends on a date that is specified. It's supposed to be more for projects. But anymore, I'm seeing more and more of these LLCs where everyone in the thing thinks that it's forever. And it ain't. But there you go. LLCs. Yeah, go ahead. You know, that's an interesting question. I wonder if you could file an amendment. You know, here's something. You never want to stir up the government to notice you. So once you get that form passed them, then you hope that they'll leave you alone. If I filed for an amendment, I would be stirring up the Secretary of State to ask questions. But I wonder if you could. I'm not sure about that. I'm sure you would have to justify why you were doing it, why the original date was incorrect. And there'd probably be fees involved and all that. But it's kind of an interesting... Honestly, I can talk like a boss about all of these except an LLC. I've done all of them, but except an LLC. And that's why I can't be as authoritative about it. I've just stayed away from them like the plague because they're just darn complicated. One thing interesting about a partnership and an LLC, it is really, really hard to sell your position. Once you're in it, you're in the program. Really? I mean, that's it. You're stuck. Selling a membership, first of all, you would be playing in securities laws that don't really like you selling things like this. You'd be dealing in a world of making tax nightmares for everyone else in the organization. It's really easy to get into something like this. It's really hard to get out. And that's something that I found out. I came out of Ohio State, with all my edumacation, my degrees, and I'm ready to go out there, take names, and kick ass in this world of business out there. And I found out that there's so much of it that I learned in halls like this, but there was so much of it that I just kind of got blindsided by, and I was just feeling my way in the dark. And one of the things that I wish someone had told me is that it sounds great. Yeah, I'm going to get into a partnership with these guys because they're all really bright and they're ready to go and they say they've got money and they know people, which is usually bull crap. They don't. We're all a bunch of puffers in the business. But then you're stuck and trying to get out turns into something very close to a nightmare. And in some cases, you can't get out until someone dies. And sometimes that takes a long time unless you work really hard to make it happen faster. God, I'm going to have to edit this podcast. And now comes the pinnacle of modern capitalism, the corporation. The corporation is a legal entity separate from its owner. When you file the articles of incorporation with the state of incorporation that you choose, if the Secretary of State sends you back the qualification, now let me make this point. The government never ever approves of anything. It will qualify you, or it will disqualify. But if it qualifies your corporation, that means the state has recognize that corporation as a living legal entity with its own set of rights and responsibilities separate from the people in it. So, this sole proprietorship is mine. Yes. This partnership is ours. Absolutely. But you go over there at a corporation, that thing is not yours. It is a child you have created. So you take it seriously when you build it. Because essentially, the Secretary of State will send you back the qualification document. That is literally a birth certificate of a legal entity. Then you will file with the federal government on Form SS-9. You don't have to remember that. But file on Form SS-9 for an FEIN, the Federal Employer Identification Number. It comes back to you within minutes. That's a social security number for a corporation. Literally, the way our system in this country works, that beast over there is a person in its own right. There was a case several years ago, Citizens United, where our Supreme Court declared that the corporations had the constitutional right of individuals to make unlimited donations to political candidates. Well, the people, the pro-business conservatives, just cheered and danced in the streets. The liberals and the leftists just screamed bloody murder. It is not it's not protected by the Constitution. Honestly, the Supreme Court is following an old, old tradition in language of taking a word, person, and expanding it. And it had been going on for a long time. There was a series of cases where the Supreme Court had been creeping forward, recognizing more and more human citizen-like rights for corporations. And now it's full-blown. The Supreme Court has essentially said a corporation is a constitutionally protected entity, a person under the law and under the Constitution. Whether that's right or not, I'll let you decide for yourself. But it's a legal entity. Now, you can file, you can incorporate in any state you want. That would, the state in which you incorporate would be your domestic, you would be domestic in that state. You are domiciled in that state. So I might incorporate in Delaware. I might incorporate in Illinois. But if I am incorporated in Delaware, I am a foreign business in Illinois. If I incorporate in Illinois, I'm a foreign business in Missouri. That's how the terminology works. Now, your location, your nexus of business can be in a state other than the one in which you incorporate. Now, why would you be an Illinois corporation? Have your nexus of business in Illinois, but incorporate in Delaware, for example, it's pretty obvious. Delaware is a very business-friendly state. It has its own court system for businesses. The judges are called magistrates, and they understand business law, respect businesses. You don't get that in a lot of states. So it might not be the best idea to incorporate in a state that has a system of judiciary that's that's ignorant of businesses or hostile to businesses. For example, Ohio, I found out, was actually damn hostile to companies incorporating. I learned that very quickly. Illinois isn't the greatest state, but it's not the worst state. I used to incorporate always my companies and my clients' companies in Delaware, but now I'm more flexible. There's some states you just don't ever, like South Dakota, Florida. I mean, you would be insane to incorporate in those states. Utah used to be a wide open Wild West, and it's turned into a real jerk place now, so I wouldn't recommend that one either. Okay, the corporation. In your accounting class, you were shown this fundamental equation of accounting. You're an accountant? Okay, you recognize that? Yeah. You know what? That means more than just assets equals liabilities plus owner's equity. That plus sign is a legal firewall that protects the owners from the liabilities of the corporation. That protects the owners from the liabilities of the corporation. It's what it does. So that if you are a corporation and you run over that dog, they can sue the company, the corporation, but they cannot go after you because you as the owner are separate from the corporation itself. And so all they have is recourse to what the company, corporation has, and the corporation doesn't have enough, the corporation collapses. But they can't go after you unless you have been stupid enough as an owner to mix funds, personal funds, with the funds of the corporation entity. Then a court could pierce the corporate veil. But that is actually very unlikely to happen. And I know that from one of my very first consulting experiences. Some years back, when I was beginning my run at the PhD, I had to take all of these MBA courses. And, of course, MBA stands for mindless babbling ass. But during my MBA experience, I had some people from the state of Ohio, employees who were working on their MBAs in the class with me. And, of course, I was hotshot. This MBA stuff is so beneath me. And turned out they worked for the Ohio EPA. And they knew that I was good at accounting and I was good at finance. And they bought me dinner one night and explained to me something was going on at the Ohio EPA. There was this guy, and it was a one-man operation. He would set up a corporation. And then with money that he put into it, and some investors, stockholders, he would then buy huge trucks, and he would go around to companies that produce toxic waste. And he would, for a fee, take the toxic waste off their hands. They washed their hands of a big mess, and toxic waste was beginning to get to be a real big issue in the 1980s. And he would just take it away for them. What he would do is then he would just drive these trucks out to the woodlands and the rivers in Ohio, and he would pour it out. Just pour it out. Just dump these, just literally thousands and thousands of gallons of everything from mercury to chlorine to sulfuric acid, you name it. It was coming out. He would just dump it out in the woods. Well, the EPA would come along, and, of course, he had a corporation, so what they would do is they would file a complaint against the corporation. Not file charges, they file a complaint. That's the way regulatory law works. And he just wouldn't show up to any court hearings on behalf of the corporation, and the corporation would essentially be judged against with the fines. And once those fines were in place, the liabilities exceeded the assets, he would simply declare the company in bankruptcy. Now, understand that all along the way, he had been paying himself as the boss huge amounts of money. So the company didn't have any money to pay these fines, so the company would just simply collapse into bankruptcy. And then he'd just form another company in about a few weeks. Of course, the Ohio EPA would go and seize the assets of the corporation, which consisted usually of a truck that was so toxic that they had to wear hazmat suits around it. That was about all the corporation had. And there he'd be, walk away, and he'd just start a new corporation that did the same thing as the old corporation did. Incredible trick. He was doing, and what they wanted me to do was testify in court that there really wasn't a corporation there, that this was just him using a phony, collapsible corporate entity for personal gain. Well, I went to one I testified once. His lawyer, well paid. I should have had that lawyer's autograph, the boot print he put on my ass in that. I was so dumb. And he just ate me alive, tossed me around the room, and made me his wife. But but anyway. No, seriously, I mean, I tell you the good, the bad, and the ugly, and that was grim. I backed off, you know, FTS on this kind of consulting for a while. Expert witness my butt. Okay. So there you go. Interestingly enough, that was pretty clear that there was no corporate veil, but because he met all of the numbers, he never used the company's bank accounts for his own personal purposes. He merely wrote himself a regular paycheck from the corporation for his work as an executive of the corporation. The court could find no way to pierce the corporate veil. And so this guy ruled on through the 80s doing this. There is a bright side to this story. As I understand it, in the later 1990s, he died rather badly from brain cancer. Seems that he didn't wear any hazmat suit himself when he dumped that crap out of his trucks all those years. But so there you go. But anyway, nasty stuff, nasty business. Corporations come in two flavors. Now, there is the C corporation, the classic. And then there's the S. The C corporation is a pain in the butt because at the bottom line, and they give you some great examples of the book in the book of this, and I'll tell you right now, I suck at accounting, but here's how it works. Now, your taxable income, let's say it's $5,000. Let's do $50,000, okay? Now, drill it down, and let's say you're in the 30% tax bracket. So your tax on that, what the hell is $50,000 times 30%? For God's sake, someone help me out. I can do it. Get off me. There. Net income, and that would be $35,000. Here's the problem, though. Let's say you distribute some of that to your dividend, your shareholders. They want a dividend. You see, you can do two things with your with your net income. You can give it as dividends, or you can plow it back into the company. You give it out as dividends, you don't have it anymore. But then you're a shareholder's bitch. If you put it back into the company, your stock might grow in price. They might realize capital gains. And that's a big problem for an early corporation, is that you're going to have shareholders crying for dividends, and you're going to be saying, look, I want, we're putting this money back into the company. Quit it. I actually went to a shareholder meeting for a company that had been in business for 3 years, and they were in no position to be giving dividends. Every penny they were making at the bottom line, they were plowing back into R&D and all kinds of stuff. That shareholder meeting, they wanted me to speak on to address questions the shareholders had. And I mean, there was this woman, she was out there, she had put a lot of money in this company, bought stock in the company, you know, that's your ownership position. And she was just yelling, we want a dividend, show us something. You know, you have to be professional with people like that. I just said, look, bitch. But anyway. But here's the thing, is that you drill down. Let's say we give them $10,000 minus dividend. Give them $10,000. You got 100 shareholders, send them each a check for $10 or $100, something like that, okay? Well, then you've got $25,000. First things first, you don't have that $10,000 to plow back in, but you have made your shareholders at least a little bit happy. One thing I've warned companies about, once you start paying a dividend, you're in the program. You were doing well this year, so we're going to get a dividend out. Well, they're going to start expecting that every time, every year. So once you start that dividend, if you stop doing it, your stock price is just going to go boom like that into the ground. Well, apparently they just had a one, that was a one-off, and now they're dying. So be careful when you do this. Okay, now here's the problem, though. These people, the shareholders who get that, they will have to pay tax on that dividend. So because that's income to them. So that's what we mean by that double taxation problem, is that in a C corporation, there's double tax. Essentially, the government gets to have a whack at the money twice. They whack the money here, and then they whack the money again here. Now, here's something that really, I mean, there are things in tax law. I do not represent to be a tax law expert. God knows the IRS auditors would attest to that on me. But one thing that's amazing, you say, well, why don't we just not pay dividends? We make sure that the kinds of shareholders we get are the ones who want that higher risk of plowback and possible capital gain in the stock price. Well, it turns out that there is a tax law that prevents a company from inappropriately gathering retained earnings. In other words, you will get fined as a corporation if you don't pay dividends under certain circumstances. So essentially, they're going to force you into the double taxation problem Because if you don't pay dividends and thereby avoid the double taxation, they're going to say, oh, you're putting all this money back into your retained earnings, and that's a naughty no-no. We'll fine your butt for that. So, that one just irritates the hell out of me. But anyway, S Corporation. Now, my company that I run right now, I actually, in a Business 100 class about 4 years ago, 5 years, I actually had them help me form the corporation. It had been a sole proprietorship. The sole proprietorship was recognized by the state of Illinois. It was called Emergent Light Studio. And so I decided it was time to make this a corporation, and I could use it as a teaching tool to freshmen to show them, well, here are financial statements, here's how a small company works. Don't think that the whole world is these megacorps. There's really this backbone of tiny companies like mine. All that. Well, that was, anyway. So I formed the corporation. Once the corporation, you have to put on the back end of it a signature that is corporate. You can say, Inc., Incorporated, Co., Company. In Illinois, they'll actually let you put LTD, limited, for it, as in limited liability and all that. So I actually had my students in that one Business 100 class that night when I created the corporation, right in front of their eyes. I let them decide which one it was going to be. Is it going to be Emergent Light Studio Company, Emergent Light Studio Inc., and Emergent Light Studio Co.? They voted for Inc., and that's what it's been ever since, is Emergent Light Studio Inc. However, I don't want C Corporation double taxation. If a company is small enough and has a small enough number of shareholders, it can file for S Corp status. It can elect to be an S Corp. The thing about an S Corp is that the money flows straight to the shareholders as dividends. Like a partnership, and so that it doesn't get the double taxation trick, which is kind of nice, but at the same time, I screwed it up, and what happened was the first year of the corporation, now you're supposed to elect S Corp status as soon as you make the animal. Well, I waited until the end of the year. You know, when I filed my taxes, you can file this form. I'm late with filing for S Corp status, but here it is. And I am filing on form 1120S instead of the regular corporate 1120, blah, blah, blah. And I prepared all of this in one of those business tax software programs called TurboTax. I hit it electronically. Ah, that's over with. Ha. Huh. Months and months later, I found out that stupid-ass program did not send the S-Corp election form. It just doesn't do it. Well, it's a known issue with our software. The IRS was eating me alive. And fortunately, they cut me mercy because I was threatening to kill myself or something. They let me do a way back, and I actually showed them the form. I printed it out from TurboTax, and I showed them the file date and all that, and they said, oh, yeah, we know about this, all that kind of stuff. And so they let me really late elect S Corporation. So if you IRS people are out there listening, why, I thank you very much, and leave me alone. I'll get my quarterlies filed soon, I promise. Anyway, S Corp. It's nice. The one thing, though, is with an S-Corp, you don't have as much latitude raising money. It's like these other things like LLCs and partnerships. Once you're in it as a stockholder, it's not that easy to get out of it, your investment. You can't just sell your stock to someone else. It's a little bit more of a pain in the derry rear. And I'm going to go into more of this in more detail in this course so you have a deeper understanding. But understand this, most of what I'm going to teach you is about corporations because capitalism is all about corporations. It's really not about the working people and it's not about these little things like sole proprietorships and partnerships. We really, in courses like this, we ignore that backbone of the entrepreneurial spirit. I see these shows. There's some kids here. They were my students who are doing something called Backpack, and they were on Shark Tank and all of that, getting money. That's the capitalist way. OPM, other people's money. and all that. So this course is going to focus on the corporate model, and it's going to specifically focus on the C Corp model. Now, here is the thing about that. Once we have moved to the point where we're talking about corporations, which is what I'm going to do most of my work talking about is corporations in this course, we understand that there is one and only one goal of a corporation. There is one and only one goal of a corporation. Do you know what it is? No. That's a consequence. Yes. Well, you're on the right track. It's to maximize the wealth of the shareholders. To maximize the wealth of the shareholders. Know this. Have any of you heard or been taught the idea of stakeholders in a corporation? You heard that term, stakeholders? Well, we don't have just the stockholders. We have, you know, the employees. We have the society. We have Mother Earth, in fact. Bullshit! The only thing that matters to us in a corporation is the shareholders. They are all that matters because it's the shareholders who can fire us at the executive management level. So if we screw up Mother Earth, we screw up for our workers, that is secondary. We have to understand that if we screw our workers over, like Bezos has been doing with Amazon all these years, and now he's blubbering that he doesn't do it. Bullshit, he does it. The only reason that matters to the shareholders is because it might drive their stock price down when the bad reputation gets out there. That's the only reason it would matter to us. The only reason Mother Earth matters to us is because if we screw it up enough the way we are right now, we're going to have our factories flooded out like they already are. We're now busting our butts with contingent plans on the coast trying to figure out how to move our factories inland. That's how bad it is out there right now. That's why it matters to us, not because of the primary of the share of the employees, the environment, and all that. It matters to us because it will adversely impact shareholder wealth. And that's why we care about it. The problem is that within a corporation, we have an agency dilemma. Agents have a bad habit of maximizing their own welfare instead of that of the principal. Now, I'm going to go through that next week in a longer lecture. But know this. We talk about shareholder wealth, but that's not the only thing that matters to us. I'm going to let it go. I've got another topic, but I'll let that go. That's all I have for you. I thank you.